This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, your pop culture home.
Yeah, Frank here has got his own billiard room.
Yes, it's what do you call it, Kramer?
Billiard room.
No, not billiard, not the billiards. It was
billiards room.
Come on already. Come on, we call it the
Place to Be.
The Place to Be, yes, the Place to Be.
Then I shall be there.
Now, it's time. Live and in living color.
The Grandy Man can.
Time to play the game!
Well, you always left me satisfied and smiling, so...
That's what she said!
Why do I want this? I want to make bank, bro. I want to get ass. I want to drive a Range Rover.
Place to Be Nation, Scott Criscola and Justin Rosero. This is the Place to Be Podcast.
Very nice, Mr. Criscola.
Oh, I'm sorry, Dennis.
D'Lo Brown interfered with a frog splash and hit it on Severin, getting some revenge.
I know.
What the hell was it? What was that laugh? It was like an old cartoon fucking Hanna-Barbera dog or something. It was like Snidely? Was that the fucking dog that laughed like that?
JR's got a little more time than I do to sit and actually write a whole show.
This is the third time you said it to me today now. I'm really curious.
Well, I'm not saying that you have nothing to do. I'm just saying that
I'm curious how I have more free time than
no,
you.
I'm gonna,
where what is does it? That mean?
Well... I don't know.
I know it's been a rough, and I'm not used to this long, grueling podcast schedule.
Oh, for fuck's sakes. Are you guys just joking about for the next hour?
Fun. Did you say D'Amato, late 20s, 30s?
Just being...
And you included yourself in that as well?
I was being nice to him. I am still technically in my 30s.
I think they might hit a shock wall.
What the fuck is a shock wall?
Is that the Shockmaster's wall?
You go through the shock wall.
Yeah, I like Big Dick myself. PTB Nation. Let me know what you're
opening.
To do worse than Josh Richard. She be standing next to me. I belong to you. You belong to me. You're my sweetheart. I belong to you. You belong to me. You're my sweetheart. Yeah, we need it now. Let's hope. Whoa, son. So,
Place to Be Nation. Welcome back to another great episode of the one and only Place to Be Podcast. I am your co-host, Justin Rosero, coming at you live on this Wednesday evening inside the PTB Man Cave. We're shaking things up a little bit. You know, it's almost like a rehash of something that happened about 6 weeks ago and never aired due to technical issues, but we are back at it. Scott Criscola running a little bit late. He'll be here shortly. So stepping in, the primary host of the great Where the Big Boys Play podcast, of course, the one and only Mr. Chad Campbell. Chad, how you doing?
Doing awesome. I'm excited.
Welcome to the A show, my friend. No more territories for you.
That's right.
No more local access wrestling for you.
I'm up in the big leagues tonight.
Up in the big time. Up in the big time. So, of course, Chad is also the assistant to the managing editor, placetobenation.com. And we have a really good show lined up, Chad. Why don't you explain what we're here to do tonight?
Well, this will be the first of a ongoing series we'll be doing on the Place to Be podcast probably every other month or so. And we're going to call them the Place to Be Nation Summit. So we're going to, of course, have you and Scott there, the regular host of the Place to Be podcast. And then we're going to be bringing in different nation members. Tonight we have a faction from ProWrestlingOnly.com. Mm-hmm. We have Charles, who's the admin over there, and then we also have Peter, who's been posting there and at Death Valley Driver for a long time, really knows his stuff, has a great voice, and so they'll bring the knowledge, and we're going to be talking about tag team wrestling tonight, which I'm really excited about.
Yeah, kind of carrying over from last week when Scott and Graham and I did the tag team tournament.
Right.
Now we're going to be breaking down some different aspects, and you've kind of come up with some ideas. You're going to be running point on this, so it's kind of a cool meeting. First time we've had these guys on the show. But not the first time you would have heard them if you visit our website. So, Chad, let's take a minute to talk about placetobenation.com. Let me run through some articles first, and then you can give us the lowdown on the podcast and where we've heard Charles and Peter before. So today we had a lot of sports going on. I started my what's going to be a regular column this year, Welcome to Friartown, Section 103. As many of you know, including Dennis Nunez, I have season tickets to the Providence Friars.
And I will be pretty much at every game. And I don't know if I'll be after every game or every couple weeks. I'm going to do a little installment, just kind of status of the Big East, the new Big East, and the state of the program that's really in a rebuilding mode. Maybe just coming out of the rebuilding mode and now into a legitimate tournament team mode. So it should be a really fun year at the Dunk, and I'll be following that along as we move through the season. Also, Todd Gessling been killing it this week. Did a great article on running out of options, looking at all the different read option quarterbacks in the league and why they're struggling in the NFL this year, including Robert Griffin, Colin Kaepernick, and a few others. Scott Criscolo did a piece on sports officiating, which, you know, sticks in my craw every night. I hate referees and umpires alike, and Scott nails why things don't ever seem to ever get better due to the fiefdom included there. Of course, our TV special fall previews continued. We had Agents of the Shield. We had all the ABC shows were previewed as well. The Goldbergs, Trophy Wife, and Back in the Game. And, of course, those continue on. And tomorrow, we'll have Parenthood. Jen Engel and I did that. We missed the 90s style. Went back and forth with emails. Chad, what else is on tap for tomorrow, article-wise?
Well, I don't know if it'll quite be tomorrow, but it'll be in the next couple of days. We have another big manifesto from Josh Richer.
Oh, nice.
So be on the lookout for that. And we should have our regular Thursday hard-traveling fanboys. And I also know that Todd Weber should be reviewing the pilot of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. within the next couple of days. So we'll have that as well.
Great. And also, of course, the NFL Week 4 Power Rankings will be up tomorrow morning, Thursday morning, depending on when you're listening to this. Also, one other Todd Gessling piece talked about blowouts and basically unfair scheduling. And not maybe not unfair, but questionable scheduling in the world of college football. Basically, what are these big brand teams have to gain by slaughtering these lesser teams by, you know, 50, 60, 70 points. So Todd examines that as well. Chad, why don't you tell us about some of the podcasts that have popped up over the last few days and also where we can hear Charles and Peter?
Well, Charles is the co-host of Wrestling with the Past, which they've done 4 episodes now. Their last episode was on cage matches, and it was my personal favorite that they've done so far. They really ran down the psychology within a cage match, went through all the big promotions, all the big NWA cage matches, all the WWE or WWF cage matches up to around the year 2000, talked about whether they are a fan of the Escape the Rules cage or not. So that's a really good show that you need to give a listen to if you haven't already. And then Peter was on Mine and Parb's 4-hour AWA special. He went through watching all the AWA 80s matches as well, so we had him on there to talk about that. On the other podcasts that have been popping up on the site the past couple of days, Titans of Wrestling is brand new. It's WWF August to October 1979. A couple of the feature matches on that is the Bob Backlund versus Pat Patterson cage match, and also Pat Patterson versus Ted DiBiase for the Intercontinental title. So those are your two big marquee matches that Parv and the gang look at there. And then we also have the fourth Brad and Chad show, which both Scott and Justin were on. And that was a really cool show, I thought, where we looked at some nostalgia items, action figures, VHS tapes, DVDs, other miscellaneous items. And then we also talked about kind of star ratings and us, I guess, becoming more of a smarter fan in the realm of wrestling.
And a cameo by the Doobie Brothers.
Yes, yes.
That was like a limited collector's edition. If you heard Brad and Chad today on Wednesday, you heard a little bit something special during the show, but it's now gone. So
got a little Easter egg.
Only a few early arrivers.
Also, Richard and the Mailman were back at it yesterday.
Did you listen to this one yet?
I have not. I actually have finally caught up on the Breaking Bad, the penultimate episode. My wife had surgery early Monday, so Sunday night was a hectic time, and I didn't get to watch it, and I luckily avoided all spoilers. But they talk about that and the Emmys and a meltdown. Apparently there's a lot on this one.
Oh, there is a meltdown, my friend. Mr. Machado really gets under Mr. Richard's skin, and Josh storms off at one point, and it gets a lot of hand, but it's always entertaining, that show. Definitely check that out, and hopefully your wife is doing okay, Chad?
Yeah, she's doing great. Okay. I actually had to run and get her dinner before that, so I've had quite the honey-do list the past couple of days. But then also Kings of Sport.
Yep.
One of those should be posted by the time you probably hear this, and that'll have a need of Place to Be Nation crossover too, because TJ McClune was their guest mm-hmm. on that show. It's his second appearance on that show.
And of course, Nate Milton, if you know him from The Law, Live Audio Wrestling, Review and Impact, he hosts that show, one of the three co-hosts. So great guy, Nate. Definitely check that out.
And then coming up this weekend, I know we got your usual weekend stalwarts, Off the Top Rope, Answer the 10 Count, should be another Grapple Talk thrown in there. So we definitely have you covered.
And the last Grapple Talk, by the way, a big interview they had.
Yes, yes. They were able to have Brendan Schaub, who fought on the Saturdays.
And won, right? He kicked some ass.
Yep. Yep, he won. And then also Sean Smith and John Medeski, who are two, you know, pretty their main card fighters in the UFC. So Grapple Talk's been able to get some big names to be on the show, some cool exclusive interviews that you'll only hear on the Grapple Talk podcast.
Indeed, sir. And also one last reminder too, if you're going to order something via Amazon, whatever it is, it could be anything in the world. If you're going to go to Amazon, hey, do us a favor, visit placetobenation.com. On the right-hand side, about halfway down, there's a massive link. You can't miss it. You click on that and you go to Amazon, and then you'd make it like a normal trip. But if you click through us, we get a little bit of sponsorship cash, and you can help keep this show and this site free and help us up and running. So if you head over there, if you're going to anything you're going to buy on Amazon, just one quick click through here and you are good to go. And Place to Be Nation will be the benefit, benefit from that.
Yes.
All right. Well, let's take a break. We'll sort that out. And when we come back, Scott should be with us, as well as Peter and Charles, and we'll get this party started.
Because.
Attaboy.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What I'd like to have right now.
Chad, do you ever feel that the world revolves around WWF?
I think you mean WWE there, Parv.
Yeah, whatever, but what about David Crockett?
Well, what about Jimmy Valiant?
I'm gonna get y'all until I get you, Paul Jones.
Oh. The Four Horsemen.
We are a family, and we are the best.
The Omni, the Dangerous Alliance.
Please welcome the newest members of the Dangerous Alliance. I'm Anderson and Larry Zbysko.
Jim Cornette and the Midnight Express.
The Fantastics are putting the U.S. Tag Team title on the line against the Midnight Express.
Main events with actual work rate in them.
Woo! 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 All right!
It's just not fair to Flair.
It's not fair for Flair.
If this is what you're looking for, please check out Where the Big Boys Play podcast, the only pure NWA and WCW supercard podcast out there.
While you were in Hollywood making movies, Thunderlips, I was winning world titles.
Well, there they are, our good friends Chad and Parr, Where the Big Boys Play. Now, if you want nonstop old-school NWA discussion, dating back to that very first Starrcade, these guys have it covered. Even the PICs have made an appearance once. We are very particular what podcasts we visit. So check out our friends Chad and Parr, Where the Big Boys Play. Their link is right on our site, placetobenation.com. Just go into the podcast menu, and there they are, with the other great shows we partner with. Chad and Parr, working Where the Big Boys Play. Speaking of Place to Be Nation, that's your everyday home for your pop culture needs. At placetobenation.com, we have everything. Wrestling, sports, comics, even polls. We want your opinions as well. Every day, there's something different with our top staff of writers who are experts in all fields of pop culture. From the weekly Raw review to the return of the hack, you've got everything you need. We're also working with a myriad of great podcasts. Of course, besides Chad Parr, we have Grapple Talk, the fans podcast, Off the Top Rope, Answering the 10 Count, We Found New Music, and the Kings of Sport with Nate Milton. We've got everything for your listening pleasure. So check us out every day of the week at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. Now, don't forget about our good friend Graham Cawthon and the history of WWE.com. He's still the top source for all argument solvers, from match results to house show cards to pay-per-view histories. Any questions you need answered, any debates among wrestling fans that need ending, head over to Graham's treasure trove of information. You will certainly find it. Need to know what the opener of Starrcade 1995 was? What was the main event of that 1988 Boston Garden house show you went to when you were 11 years old? Graham can tell you. He has WWE, WCW, ECW results, and the growing results in TNA and Ring of Honor. So for all your wrestling research needs, check out Graham Cawthon at thehistoryofwwe.com. Now finally, if you want a place to just hang out, discuss all things wrestling with fellow diehard fans, Check out the news and the great forums at TWFnews.com. They have all the up-to-the-minute stories in WWE, TNA, and pretty much everywhere in between. They talk old school, Attitude Era, and even those hard-to-remember guys and shows like Waylon Mercy or In Your House Number 3. But check out all there is to see right on TWFnews.com.
This is Gary Michael Capetta, and this is the Place to Be podcast with Scott Riscola and Justin Rosero.
All right, Nation, we are back, and we are ready to kick off this roundtable. I'm going to throw things over to Chad Campbell, who's going to set things up and get this going.
All right, and the gang is all here. We have Charles, co-host of Wrestling with the Past and administrator of ProWrestlingOnly.com.
Hi.
Charles, how you doing?
I'm good. How about you?
And we have... We have Peter. Yeah, I'm doing good. We have Peter, who's a distinguished poster on ProWrestlingOnly.com and who has watched quite a ton of wrestling footage in the past couple of years and chronicled that. How are you doing tonight, Peter?
I'm doing good.
Okay, and then we also have Scott. Scott has come in, and he is here as always. So, Scott, I'm taking it you're doing good tonight as well.
It is a wonderful evening, Chad. It is good to talk to you. JR, of course, always a pleasure, and PTB Nation. And Charles and Peter, welcome to the zoo.
Oh,
hopefully your opinions of wrestling will not change, or us for that matter.
Thank you very much. You might say that this is really the place to be.
Shameless plug. You're in, Charles. Shameless plug. Cheap pops. That's what we like here.
Anybody that's a frequent listener of Wrestling with the Past knows that there is no joke Charles is below, so he will make any joke at any level. But we have an exciting topic tonight. Like I said in the open, we have a bevy of tag teams that we're going to kind of discuss, shoot around roundtable style. I kind of want to make it a little conversational, though, too. So the first team we're going to talk about is one of my personal favorites. It's the Brainbusters, or Tully Blanchard and Arn Anderson. So I will go to Charles first on which member he thought was the best of just this tag team, and then also which member he thinks had the better career long term.
Just within the tag team, I think that's a tough one. I would probably say Tully Blanchard. I think Arn Anderson was the more physical wrestler and was the guy who was kind of the ass kicker of the two. But what I think made Tully special is that Tully was the guy who got the heat. So Tully was the guy who always knew how to position the referee and who knew how to cut off the hot tag at just the right time. And Arn was great at those things too, but Tully is almost unparalleled at doing those things. So within the tag team, I'd probably go with Tully. Now, if you're looking at their careers as a whole, I do think Tully also peaked higher as a singles wrestler, but he didn't have the longevity that Arn Anderson had for obvious reasons that I think we all know. But and it's a shame because the few times that we've seen Tully Blanchard pop up in the 90s, he's looked really good. So I think he still had it, and he still had at least another 5 years in him where he could have been productive and had a good career. And that's at a minimum. So I think probably within the team, I would say I'd say Tully. But overall, it's a little bit closer, but I'm still going to just give Tully the edge just because I think he peaked higher than Arn, even though Arn had a longer, more productive run.
Now, JR and Scott, y'all can probably chime in on this. I'm trying to kind of think of, a sports comparison with Arn Anderson, because as I've went through kind of the footage that I've been watching the past couple of years, Arn I would classify as a great wrestler, but I think more than that, he was a real consistent type
wrestler.
Okay.
How about Johnny Damon? Guy who played for a bunch of teams, blended in wherever he went, made other guys better, not necessarily the star of the team, but always very consistent in his production and his numbers.
Yeah, I like that. That's pretty good. I would say like Arn Anderson is someone that's not, in the Wrestling Observer Newsletter Hall of Fame, but certainly for the season, which we have about 11 years, and he's also somebody that's really – I think, the benefactor of someone that we really see his whole career on tape. I mean, pretty much every significant match of his, both in the NWA and the WWF, and then back when he came to WCW, has made tape. So it's really cool to kind of see his whole plight as a career. But Scott, what is your opinion on this tag team? Are you in pro Arn or pro Tully, or which one?
Well, Arn was always, as much as most of the listeners obviously know, Ric Flair is my favorite of all time wrestler, but Arn was always my favorite horseman. So I definitely, for this tag team, I definitely have to give the edge to Arn. Consistency is the key in tag teams, in my opinion, and I don't think I've ever seen Tully or Arn have a bad match. And he was, I think he was more the foundation. He was the setup guy, and Tully was the finisher. Just like when, and we may talk about this a little later, when Arn was with Ole, it was in the reverse. Ole was the setup guy and Arn was the finisher. And then Ole would sometimes, put the knee to the shoulder and then the arm bar. But a lot of times, Arn would use the gourd buster to finish. Whereas Arn took the Ole role with Tully. And that's why I think for a guy who was a foundation guy, and then Tully was kind of the finisher. So I have to say, in terms of setting up the matches, I have to give the edge in terms of the better guy to Arn within the team.
Peter, what's your frame of reference with this tag team growing up, and then also if you've been watching your wrestling footage throughout the years?
Well, growing up, the greater familiarity was actually with the WWF when they came in with Bobby. And then more recently, watching the yearbooks, Arn is all over those yearbooks in every conceivable role. And Tully has one token appearance with the AWA, and his career is pretty much over. But I've seen enough of Tully to know that as a peak singles worker, he was better than Arn. But within the context of the tag team, I'm also going to have to go with Arn. He just came across as more of the dynamic ass kicker, as was just said. I don't know if Arn could ever really be described as flashy, but within the context of the Brain Busters, I think he came across that way, both on offense and bumping and stooging for the heel, for the baby faces.
Okay. Now, I want to touch on a couple of their matches together. One is the NWA Great American Bash 1988 opener, where they fought Sting and Nikita Koloff in a 20-minute draw. I think that's a great kind of feather in the cap for the team of Arn and Tully. That was their last NWA-WCW supercard appearance. You had a really green Sting who was very over-exuberant in the ring, kind of jumping around and really had to be reined in. And even, I mean, in that clash 45-minute draw, which I'm not too fond of, but I do think it's a very good match with Flair, you do see him kind of repeating spots, and he certainly is someone that had to be sort of led through that match by Flair. So this is him in another longish match in a showcase match, and Nikita in 1988 was no great shakes either. So I think that match is really good for both Arn and Tully in showing how they could kind of lead opponents through a great match. Now, Charles, I know a match that you're fond of is also on the Clash 1 show, and that's the tag title change match.
Yeah, and what I think is so impressive about that is that it happens on the same show as the Midnight Express versus Fantastics match. Both are your classic like Southern tag matches where there's a face in peril sequence and there's a build to a hot tag, but both are completely different as far as how they're worked. So the Midnight Express Fantastics match is more of like a crazy brawl with tables and chairs going everywhere, where the Arn Tully versus Luger Wyndham match is just, you know, four guys cutting a really fast pace and keeping the crowd going. I think that finish is probably one of the loudest pops I've ever heard for a title change.
Yeah,
it was huge. It was huge. And, you know, something else I was thinking about with Arn and Tully, when they left the NWA and went to the WWF, I mean, you always hear it, probably because I won't shut up about it, but you always hear a lot about how, you know, the tag team scene in the NWA was so much better than the tag team scene in the WWF. if you look at 1989, I think that if you look at the Brainbusters Rockers feud, the WWF may have had the better tag team scene in 1989 than WCW, that had teams like the Freebirds dominating the tag titles. And I mean, it was in the Steiners, who I think hadn't quite come into their own yet. So, and Doom, I think, had a better 1990. So, I mean, you might say that, you know, wherever Arn and Tully were, they made that the place to be.
Again, with the cheap pop.
What are you looking for, prizes?
I love it. I love it.
This isn't a trivia contest.
Justin, I want you to talk about kind of some of Arn's other partners, and we can go around the group here. Who was your favorite second partner for Arn besides Tully, or maybe even your first, if you want to be as bold as to say that?
It's going to be the Enforcers. When I first really got into WCW, it was late 91, right around when the Dangerous Alliance was really ramping up. And so that was really my first taste of Arn outside of some tapes and things he had done with Tully and the WWF. So I didn't really know the Horsemen, per se, or Arn and Tully until I went back and kind of learned more. So my first taste of him was with Larry, and I love the Cruncher stuff when they broke Wyndham's wrist or hand, and the War Games match with the blow off to the Dangerous Alliance. I just really like that team. I thought they had a cool name, a good look, and just like two douchebags. I mean, that's what they were, right? They were two assholes, so it was perfect. The great heel team.
Now, Scott, I think you have another tag team that is your second favorite Arn pairing.
Oh, yeah, there's no question. I have always been an Arn and Ole guy. Again, for what I mentioned earlier, Arn is just such a multifaceted guy when it comes to tag teams. He's had so many different types of partners. I talked about how he was the foundation guy and Tully was the finisher. But with Ole, it was the reverse. That's where Arn learned foundation, from Ole. And I just love watching those two guys just dissect jobbers at such a great rate. And Ole, I think, doesn't get as much of a fair shake as he should in the new generation of fans, mostly because a lot of people see him as a crazy old man who sits around hotels talking about like the old dogs and at the conventions. But he really gave Arn a real lesson in how to be an awesome tag team wrestler. And so I love Tully and Arn. I love the Brainbusters. But my favorite Arn tag team partner will always be Ole for that reason, because he made Arn that kind of tough foundation guy that can lay out a match, particularly in a tag team, like nobody's business.
Now, Peter, I wanted to ask you, as someone that has recently completed a ton of 1991 and 1992 watching, first, what are your thoughts on the Arn Eaton team? Because that's a pairing of what a lot of people would say are two of the best tag wrestlers of all time. And then why do you think they sort of switched from the Enforcers to Arn Eaton?
Well, I think they figured that, like you said, they could combine sort of a dream team of the two of the best tag teams of all time, or at least the best tag teams of the 80s. And that was the impetus behind eventually putting them with Michael Hayes, so they would have members from three of the best tag teams of the 80s. Sadly, I think Eaton trailed off quite a bit in 1992. He was pretty banged up, which is not too surprising considering the style he worked. And they also suffer a bit because neither their tag title win or tag title loss, to my knowledge, made tape. They were both in the Omni when they were at the peak of trying to make that arena like the Madison Square Garden of the South or whatever. So we're missing some of their bigger matches. So that leads me to sort of go with Zbyszko as my other favorite Anderson partner. They were not just assholes. They were old, middle-aged assholes wanting all these other tag teams to get off their damn lawn.
Awesome.
And they, yeah. And Arn was all cut these deadly serious promos, and Zbyszko would bring in these, like, references to, you know, literary references and science references, just trying to prove that he's, like, the smartest guy in the room. And then they would kick your ass during the match, or before the match, or after the match.
Now, before we get off this, I did want to ask Charles one more question, mainly based on Arn Anderson. because this is something that he wrote, I guess it was a couple months ago, but I'd never really given much thought to it. But Arn Anderson certainly had great matches in the 90s, both in singles and tag. The match versus Lord Steven Regal at Super Brawl in 1994 is one that I can point out too. But one thing that you said, Charles, was that Arn's promo style, as Peter just sort of touched on, didn't really change that much from the 80s to 90s. And he really did kind of evolve as a worker from a more brawling sense into a more kind of technical, cerebral type worker. So I wonder if you could just kind of touch on that and whether you thought like Arn lost a little spark as a character or overall kind of how his career plight went.
Yeah, I think what I would point to is the biggest example of that is 1996. And the build to the War Games match at Fall Brawl, where it was going to be, you know, the Horsemen and Sting and Luger teaming for the first time ever against the NWO. And Arn had such amazing promos hyping that match. Had the famous line, "You send one of ours to the hospital, we'll send two of yours to the morgue." Then he had the line, you took a baseball bat to me and your biggest mistake was that you should have used battery acid. That's what I would have done. Like, he had like amazing lines. And so he even said at one point that he already called ahead and reserved himself a hospital bed, which I don't know that that's possible, but I guess I could see Arn bullying like some orderly into making that happen. But so then War Games happens and, he just kind of wrestles it like it's just any other match. So I felt like if you're going to do promos like that, you have to go in the ring and give a bigger than normal performance. And it was just Arn Anderson, you know, throwing punches and doing his thing. And it wasn't bad, but it didn't feel great. Like, he was doing great promos. And so you expect him to go in and have the match of his life. And it just didn't happen.
We may be talking about Arn a little bit later. We're going to kind of count down some of our best tag workers of all time. I have a feeling he might show up. But I want to transition into a tag team I'm really excited to talk about because I think they had two distinctive runs and two very good runs where you can say they were some of the they were the best tag team in that promotion for long sequences of time, and that's the Rockers. Now, the motif seems to be with Marty Jannetty, with a lot of people, that he was kind of missed his mark and sort of a lost potential type guy because he got burnout, did the drugs, and kind of screwed up every chance he was given. But I want to ask Scott first, just within the Rockers and kind of up till the end of their breakup in 1991, did you think Marty or Sean was the best member of just that tag team together?
Well, I'm going to use the same philosophy that I used with Arn and Tully. And for me, particularly in their WWF run, I have to say Marty was the better tag team, better worker within the tag team till about 1990. And then that's, I think, when Marty started as Jesse so eloquently said to Gorilla once, dipped into the joy juice. And I think that's when Sean kind of became the alpha dog. But definitely from their inception in 85 through the AWA up until, you know, through they came to the WWF and up to 1990, I definitely think Marty was the guy who was the dictator, the pace of the matches and how it looked. And I think he set Sean up kind of similar to what Greg Valentine used to do for Brutus Beefcake in the Dream Team. I think he kind of helped set him up and kind of get Sean in the right spots to make him shine. And then by 1990, I think it was evident that that Sean finally was able to flip the switch and was the pure worker that everybody knew he would eventually become. And that's when I think it turned. But by then, I think that the team had reached its point. But I'd have to say, at least in their peak, which would be from 86 when they were feuding with Summers and Rose and in the AWA, and then they had that little cup of coffee in Continental through the WWF. Up until probably WrestleMania 6 through SummerSlam, I think the main guy in that team was Marty.
All right. Charles, I'll pose the same question to you, and then I also want you to kind of touch on some kind of unheralded gems throughout their early 90s WWF run as far as from a match quality standpoint.
When I watched Rocker's matches, I don't remember ever really thinking that one guy was way ahead of the other. I remember at the time in the late 80s, like Shawn Michaels was getting a little bit more play in magazines just because he had the Hurricane Rana, which they weren't actually naming at the time. It was just more of a flying head scissors if they called it anything, but it was a hot move and it was like a cool thing. And that was kind of associated with him for a long time. So, he had that. And I think, he was also put in a few positions to have singles matches here and there that I don't know that Jannetty was, where Shawn Michaels would face top guys like Ted DiBiase and Mr. Perfect. And, I don't really remember seeing Jannetty in those same types of matches. As far as Rocker's matches that I think are kind of under the radar, the biggest one that I would point to would be a match that they had with the Powers of Pain, believe it or not, on January 15th, 1990 in Madison Square Garden. That match is way, way, way better than it had any right to be, to the point where I kind of wish it had opened a pay-per-view at some point. Yeah. Just so it could get the recognition that it deserves. They really played up the size dynamic so much. And I remember, I've heard Sean talk about it before. He was so dumbfounded when he came to the WWF because his size had never been a disadvantage anywhere. In fact, the bigger guys kind of liked working with him because they could play it up and it was a way to have a good match. And in the WWF, it was seen as more of a detriment where guys didn't want to sell for him because of his size. But I think that this match was a match where Sean and Marty got to do the match that they felt was right. So, and the end result was, the Powers of Pain looked great in that match. Barbarian is a really good athlete, but Warlord, I don't know that he is. But there was a spot where, Sean or Marty would just kind of leap at the Warlord and then he would drop him in a power bomb. And it looks like, wow, Warlord, executed a really good looking power bomb when it was actually Sean or Marty carrying him through the sequence. So, they celebrated every victory that they got within that match, big or small, just because, they got a shot in on this huge, huge team that was going to pummel them. And they worked as huge underdogs. It was a really, really, really good match.
Yeah, and I think that's one of those type of matches where, the Powers of Pain, besides that, I'm really struggling to think of what their second best match was. But we're talking a difference if you want to kind of throw out a star rating, where I have that Rockers match about at 4, 4.25 stars. And I really don't know even if the Powers of Pain had a 3-star match after that. It is a wide discrepancy from this match to their next best match, which I think bodes well for the Rockers. Peter, I'd like for you to kind of focus on their great AWA run, and then also just within that promotion, and then later on to the WWF that you said you were more acquainted with as a child. What your thoughts on the Rockers were?
Well, obviously in the AWA, what jumps out is the series of matches with Rose and Summers, the pivotal bloodbath match on ESPN, which I think a lot of people who've never seen any AWA have seen that match, plus multiple cage matches, gimmick matches with Rose and Summers. And they also got to work with some other teams. They got to work with the Condrey and Rose Midnight Express, as well as Bad Company, Diamond and Tanaka, which later became the New Orient Express. The AWA matches, their AWA run is probably their peak, and that's probably when they were the most even as in terms of which worker was better than the other. I thought they were pretty interchangeable for most of that. I think around the time they went to Memphis on loan from the AWA, you started to see the first signs that Sean had a little more together in terms of being a single star. In Memphis, they turned heel and started feuding with Jerry Lawler and Bill Dundee. And there's one promo that sticks out at me where Michaels is being interviewed by Lance Russell talking about the over-the-hill gang, Lawler and Dundee, and he starts taking off his leather jacket. It's very prototypical Heartbreak Kid type promo. And the girls in the Memphis studio audience start squealing. And Michaels realizes, I'm a heel now. I'm not supposed to get that kind of reaction. So he quickly, very subtly, just pulls his jacket back on so he can shut them up. And stuff like that is not something I don't think Jannetty ever really picked up on. And watching the 90-91 stuff without being able to specify exactly what it was, I think Michaels started showing himself to be a more dynamic worker, both bumping and on offense. That was before the split.
Now, Justin, I know this is one of your personal favorites, so give us your thoughts and some memories of these guys.
Yeah, I agree 100% there about how Sean, by 1991, really looked to be the one trying to improve his game. And you know, Marty seemed always content just being the Rockers and doing their thing. And Sean seemed the one that had the drive, had the attitude, and wanted to make himself into a bigger star. And I think that shows itself in 91, where you can tell he's learned more of the little things. But Marty's still very good, but Sean is advancing his career and trying to move on. As a kid, when I started watching in 1990, I thought Jannetty was the star of the team, and a lot of that came from SummerSlam 90 when Sean was knocked out with his knee on the side of the ring and Marty wrestled the whole match. I thought Sean looked kind of like a bitch at the time. And, of course, I grew to love Sean as 91 dawned. But what do you guys think about them really hitting their prime, hitting their peak in 91 as far as the WWF goes with some of those matches with the Orient Express, Haku and Barbarian? And then for some reason they're completely left off SummerSlam. And then they break up. And, you know, we know the reason behind it, but were you disappointed at the time? I remember feeling a little upset because I'm like, wow, these guys are finally getting, you know, some of the big teams that held them back, like Demolition and the Hart Foundation, the Bulldogs, and these other teams that were gone. And now the Rockers are kind of becoming like the last team standing, and then they broke them up. I feel like it was just when they were starting to get to a point where maybe they could rule the division, they split. And I know why, but it just seemed kind of disappointing at the time.
Yeah, I can definitely see that, especially, I mean, it kind of goes back to one thing I mentioned before, which is that you started seeing Sean positioned against top guys in singles matches, like Ted DiBiase and Mr. Perfect around this time. And also, you know, they had just had the title switch that wasn't acknowledged. And then they had probably their best and most famous match at Royal Rumble 91 against the Orient Express. And then they followed that with like a really strong match at WrestleMania against Haku and Barbarian. So I do think they were on kind of a roll when it ended. So I can definitely see that point. I mean, there was the Ric Flair match also that Sean had, which was actually, you know, that was more just a way to build to the breakup. But you were starting to see them kind of, Sean specifically, like, interact more with headliners, which wasn't really something that they had done before 91. So I think even though they were losing those matches, it was giving a little bit of credibility to the team. And I think they could have been set up for a good run.
Yeah, I will say, too, like, that SummerSlam 1991, I mean, who would you pair them against, Justin, if you could fancy book? Because if they were in a hot opener and then you kind of finagled the main event to just have the Desert Storm match between Hogan and Slaughter that they had in MSG, if you could have done that then. I mean, SummerSlam 91 is remembered pretty fondly anyway, but I think you really could have had an all-timer there.
I would have put the Rockers in that opener with the Bulldog. Or Steamboat, whatever. Take one of them out. I would have dropped Kerry Von Erich, who was basically just mumbling to himself on the apron for most of that match anyway. But I think the Rockers and Steamboat, or Rockers and Davey Boy against Power and Glory and the Warlord would have been very good. It would have played off the year before, too, with the Rockers and Power and Glory, kind of brought an end to that feud. As far as, you know, if you look at the two... You know, I think Sean, obviously, it was proven to be the better guy. Marty seems like a guy they always wanted to bring back and give him a push. I think they saw him as a guy who could be a really stable mid-level face to help build up new stars. I think they always wanted to have him around in that role. And anytime they'd given that opportunity, he kind of flamed out. And whether it was 95 or, you know, into 96, and then he'd come back again. Even in 05, they gave him another chance. It seemed like anytime they tried to let him get a shot at that role, he would just butcher it.
Now, well, before we kind of go off the Rockers, I'll say this. Like, Shawn Michaels, to me, personally, is not someone
I know for a lot of people, he would probably be one of their, if you did like a top five wrestler of all time list or something like that, he would at least be very high. I can speak personally that he wouldn't be, I think very safely he would not be in my top 25. That's kind of not me trying to be contrarian. It's just kind of his faults in selling and some of his facial expressions and his comeback run later on in his career. I kind of made me not emotionally connect to his matches. But I don't want to speak for the panel, but I don't think anybody would ever say throughout their career, I think you still have to go with Sean Wright, even if you're not a big fan of his, because there's no denying he had great matches throughout his singles run, even the ladder matches with Ramon and then the Hell in the Cell with Taker and stuff like that. I'll take that silence to say everybody agrees. but yeah, I do think Sean overall was the better one. But let's move on for them. And this is a tag team that I'm kind of interested to hear thoughts on. And it's two guys that I think had very extended singles runs. Really probably the two guys that had the biggest singles career and then also had a pretty successful tag team together. And that's Strikeforce. So I'll throw to Scott on this one first on which member of Strikeforce he thought was the best overall, and then throughout their career, who he liked better, Tito or Rick Martel, because I do think these guys are very close throughout their career.
Yeah, this is a tough one because both guys, this is one of the rare cases where both guys were established single stars, then joined a tag team. Tito, obviously former IC champ, he was a tag champ early in his career with why am I blanking?
Putsky.
I think it's Ivan Putski. Yeah. Yeah. And then, you know, Martel's former AWA world champion. So here was a case where you had two guys who worked great in singles and needed to find a little chemistry. It's kind of hard to say because they kind of had a short shelf life. I mean, really, they were only really at their peak between late 87 and WrestleMania 4. So it's a very small template to really pick out. I got to say, I've always been a Martel guy, because he's just a better character, particularly by the late 80s when we really hit the pay-per-view era. Martel was a better character. Tito was pretty much jobber to the stars, a glorified jobber to the stars at that point. So I'll have to say Martel. I think he was the better worker, which is very close though, because Tito was no chopped meat. But I think Martel overall brings a bigger package to the table than Tito does in that aspect.
Okay.
It was very uncomfortable to see those girls in cars videos. Like Tito just looked kind of out of place. Like, hey, yeah. Ladies, yeah, you know, yeah. It's like very, very, very cheesy, but.
Actually, from what I've read, I think Virgil brings the biggest package to the late 80s.
Yeah, right from the four line in Brooklyn.
Where are you reading
Brooklyn?
About Virgil's package?
No way. Let's move on.
But I have to say, yeah. But
Titans
but,
of Wrestling, I heard it on. That's where it was.
Yeah. You stole my notebook.
But I think definitely for such a small template, because really, I mean, Tom Zink left in what, like, June 87, July 87, something like that.
Yeah.
So really from summer 87 till WrestleMania 4 when they got mollywomped by Demolition, it was a very small time period. I'd have to say easily Martel, the overall – I don't want to use package again. The overall picture, I think Martel was the more complete guy than Tito.
Okay, I have a couple of follow-ups with that. One is, now I know you was watching as a kid at this time, so what are your memories of the Tito versus Greg Valentine Intercontinental title feud? And then two, how familiar are you with Martel's AWA run, and then what did you think of his arrogance gimmick later on?
I got to be honest, we'll start from the top. The Tito Valentine match in Baltimore was probably one of my first real favorite matches. I loved the violence of it. I remember my brother and I sitting there the way that the match – it was the most vicious I'd ever seen Tito because he kicked the door in Valentine's face, and then Valentine beat the shit out of that green belt. My brother loved that belt when he was a kid. My brother's a few years older than me. And of course, it would from that would come the greatest belt ever, the classic Federation Intercontinental title that they use now. Yeah, I love that match. I know – I'm trying to remember what DVD – it's on a DVD somewhere. Might be the IC DVD, maybe. I don't totally remember much about Martel's title run because I don't really remember. I know he beat Jumbo Tsuruta.
Right.
And I know he lost to Stan Hansen at the Meadowlands. But I don't remember much about it in the middle. AWA was not on – didn't go on ESPN until like 86, 87, if I remember correctly. So by then, Stan Hansen was champion already. I love the arrogance gimmick. It was tremendous. It was perfect. Martel had the perfect kind of suave kind of swagger to be that kind of gimmick. And hey, he probably put together. He was probably the best. You could conceivably say, and this is a conversation JR and I have had a few times. Rick Martel is probably the greatest Royal Rumble worker that never won a Royal Rumble. I mean, the guy's 5-6 straight years, he was in there over 30 minutes. The guy was just a great worker. And the arrogance gimmick just fit him perfectly. I love the whole thing where he sprayed the arrogance in Jake's eyes, and we had the funny, you know, white eyeball thing going on and all that. And, of course, the unheralded blindfold match at WrestleMania 7. I think Martel just overall is one of the most underrated workers in the history of the business. Because I think when he was growing at his peak as AWA champion, not many people were watching because it wasn't on big-time television. You could watch it in the Midwest and, you know, Western Canada. But anyway, those are my answers. But Tito and Valentine is one of the better IC title matches that I don't think many people have ever watched.
Yeah. Just a quick – I mean, I know I have seen a couple of their matches based on a Will's pandering to them, wrestling with the past co-host Will. And they are – that was a great series overall. I personally like their Lumberjack match they had at MSG. Now, that's a great feud from the 80s that I don't think it's talked up enough. But, Charles, I'm interested in your thoughts on this one because as somebody that's been, you know, on the same message board with you for a while, I know kind of most of your opinions, but this is one where I really don't know which way you're going to fall.
Yeah, I don't know that I do either, to tell you the truth. I was thinking about it, and, I mean, probably if you – held a gun to my head, which I hope you won't, I would I'd probably go with Rick Martel, but I would put it in pencil instead of pen. And the reason I say that just on a surface level is because I remember, I mean, both guys actually had like significant accomplishments outside of the WWF also, but when I also think about things like Rick Martel's match with Ric Flair in All Japan, which I thought was fantastic. I haven't seen it in years, but I remember loving it. I remember Martel matches, you know, in the AWA in Portland with guys like Jerry Lawler in Memphis. So, and I can't remember ever seeing a match from anywhere really that disappointed me. So, so that's probably why I'd pick Martel. I mean, and I'm a fan of Santana too. To be honest, I've probably, at least like looking at it to see, okay, is this guy any good? I've probably seen less Tito Santana with that eye than I have Rick Martel.
Right. Peter, what's your thoughts on this one?
This is one where I sort of have to I've been trying to evaluate these guys based on what they do in the tag team. But as mentioned, Strikeforce wasn't around for that long. So I kind of have to go outside that. And I think you have to go with Martel here. The more interesting debate to me is Martel better than Ricky Steamboat? And a few years ago, I wouldn't have believed that to be a valid comparison at all. But watching the All Japan stuff, I thought Martel came across better there in similar context to Steamboat. And then he's got the AWA stuff, which he doesn't match Steamboat as far as peak, high-end, all-time great matches, but he has a ton of really great ones, really good ones in the AWA. So I'm going to have to go with Martel over Santana over this.
Okay. And I just want to, before we transition off of them, I do want to give a shout-out, and I'm sorry, I don't know his name. I hate to use
kind of message board handles on this show, but Superstar Sleaze, who posts on ProWrestlingOnline.com, he's been going through a ton of late 80s WWF matches. And one of his favorite feuds in the tag division is the Islanders versus Strikeforce. And that was a feud I'd never watched any matches of and never heard of before or talked up. But based on his write-ups, I did seek some of those out, and I was able to find their 9 September 1987 Madison Square Garden match. And that is a really, really good match. So I want to give a quick shout-out to him. But moving on to that, now, Justin, I want you to jump in on this one because I was also talking to Pete or Shu about the show today. And one team that he brought up was the Hollywood Blondes, which I know is one of your favorite tag teams. And I do think that's interesting at that point in time, whether you think Pillman or Austin was carrying that team.
Man, you're picking some tough ones, dude. These are... It's like picking nits with these teams. I liked Austin more at the time, but Pillman was great too. It was another one that just complemented each other so well, and I'm hoping there's another team we're gonna talk about later that I feel like was kind of the same, where they took two guys that were, I don't want to say struggling, but a little bit lost, and put them together to see what they could get, and they ended up just being gold. And they worked so well together. Great intuition. They always knew who the other guy was. It was one of those teams that could just kind of look at each other. You know, we talked a lot about the Rockers. I feel that they're the same way, where you could tell that they're just in one mindset. They know what they want to do, and they don't need to talk about it or look obvious that they're doing it. They just moved very smoothly. And, I'll probably say Austin, but it's really close.
Now, Charles, what's your opinion on this one?
I think the answer may vary even during the run. I think the Hollywood Blondes kind of caught Brian Pillman at the end of his best years, and it caught Steve Austin at the beginning of his best years. So, yeah. Great tag team. I really like quite a few of their matches, actually. The two that stand out the most are with Arn Anderson and Paul Roma at Beach Blast 93, and then a match they had on Worldwide with Bagwell and Too Cold Scorpio that I thought was really good, too. But, I think when the team started, Brian Pillman was probably the better of the two. Not so much, like, in terms of action, because I think Austin, like, even from the beginning of his career, the guy could go. Like, he was going to work hard and take big bumps. And, I mean, he didn't take nights off, really. But Pillman, I think, was a better heel and was more comfortable, like, in his act. And then I think by the end of it, Pillman started to decline. I don't know if he'd started to decline, but maybe it was just like the end of like his best years. And Austin was just starting to take off.
Now they had a short, real short run overall, right? Like, when did they first start teaming? Early 1993, like January, or
it was actually in late 92.
Okay,
they started teaming under Bill Watts. And then Watts left, and they kept the team together. Now, when they first started teaming, they weren't the Hollywood Blondes. They were just Steve Austin and Brian Pillman, and they just dressed just like they always did. So I don't think it was until maybe early in 93, and I don't even remember exactly when, that they actually started getting matching gear and came up with the team name. It was sometime in the feud with Steamboat and Douglas.
Okay. Now, do we feel that this team was kind of like the last bastion of glory to the old NWA days? I mean, it feels like after the Hollywood Blondes run, you had, you know, your Nasty Boys, Cactus Jack and Max Payne, and then a Harlem Heat, which is, you know, two powerhouses, faces of fear, outsiders or big guys. This really kind of feels like your last, I guess, work rate heavy, not huge guy kind of tag team that they wanted to anchor the upper mid card. Would everybody sort of agree with that?
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that's kind of a.
So we're not counting Stars and Stripes in that discussion?
No, Stars or Stripes or Kenny Chaos and Robbie Rage is High Voltage. Yes. Did not make the cut.
Metalwork.
Thunder and Lightning.
The Cold Twins.
The Cold Twins, yeah.
Thunder and Lightning, greatest tag team ever. Yeah.
Disorderly.
just to kind of, just for frame of reference, the Hollywood Blondes, I guess as
Austin and Pillman. They were, they did take on Steamboat and Douglas at Starrcade 92 in the for the combo titles, and then they won them in March on an episode of Power Hour. Ironically, they beat Steamboat and Shane, and then they disbanded in October. So yeah, it was a short window, Chad. It was pretty much right. I would say December 92 to October 93.
Yeah, I always forget.
11 months.
Yeah, I always forget that they're in that Starrcade match. I always get that and the double Steve Williams match from Halloween Havoc 92 mixed up.
But, oh, right, yeah.
Yeah, but that's the discussion for another day. But is it Steve? No, it's Pillman and Windham in the Starrcade match, isn't it?
Yeah, Starrcade 92.
Okay. Oh, okay.
But at the Clash in early 93, it was, I think that was maybe the first major Hollywood Blondes versus Steamboat and Douglas match.
Okay.
And I remember that being notable because there was a really cool, like, they did like a DQ finish with belt shots, but it was cool because they put over like the belt shot as like this something that could cause serious injury. And I mean, you had blood and everything. So I thought that was awesome. Like, if you're going to do a belt shot, make it count. So it's pretty cool.
Now, we'll transition off of them. And now this is a tag team that I want to get Peter's thoughts on first, because he has really just finished watching them as their peak. And that is Terry Gordy and Dr. Death Steve Williams. So what are your thoughts, Peter, on this tag team? And who do you think was the best member of this tandem?
I got to say their stock with me has gone down a bit watching 91, 92, All Japan stuff and a lot of stuff in WCW. Working in All Japan, it's not that they have a lot of bad matches. And frankly, their matches, if they took place in the WWF, would be considered match of the year candidates. But watching All Japan, your standards just have to be higher. And there's just a lot of they work holds a lot, and they're not really that good at working holds. I guess would be my big criticism. They do have lots of big bombs on offense. They do bump and sell very well at times for their opponents when you see guys like earlier, like Brody and Hansen, who didn't necessarily do that. So I got to give props to them for that. And they have some great matches, like just one of Jumbo's last big matches, Jumbo and Taue against them, which is really good. And a really great match at the Clash during the NWA tournament with the Steiners. But as all-time great tag teams go, I'd rather watch the Freebirds, to be honest.
Okay. And do you think their stuff in Japan was better or in the U.S.?
Probably Japan, just because there was more of it, and they were more familiar working the style. I think the U.S. they have that one really great match with the Steiners, and they have a really good match with Windham and Rhodes where they lose the tag titles. After that, as far as depth goes, there's not too much there.
Okay. What is the what's the best, in your opinion, the best Rhodes-Windham match? Is it the one on WCW Saturday Night?
Yes.
Okay.
The tag title change.
Right. Okay. Charles, what's your thoughts on this? I know this is a team you brought up. So.
Yeah, I brought them up, but I do agree 100% with what Peter said. I think the more that I've watched of them, the more their stock has gone down for me too. I mean, if I never see another Terry Gordy front face lock again in my life, it will be too soon. I don't know. I think where they were weak is that they really, not only that they weren't really good at working holds, but they also weren't really good at working feuds. So the matches didn't really progress from match to match. It was just kind of like a sideways thing, even when they were facing the same teams repeatedly. I would actually say they were better in the U.S. just because they had two standout matches that I think were probably their best matches as a team. But honestly, the reason that I brought them up was because I thought it would be cool to talk about them like as singles wrestlers and see kind of who is better mm-hmm. between the two.
And do you think you would go with Dr. Death now, or because I think the perception going in would be Gordy, just on the surface level. But I can say for me personally, like Gordy, as I did tape trading and watched watched matches here and there, Gordy was somebody that was in some kind of bona fide classic matches, like the 1988 Real World Tag League match, and then also the Texas Death Match versus Killer Khan. But he is someone where I feel like the more footage I've watched, the more his stock has dropped. His jumbo match in All Japan, his singles match, I think it's in 1984, didn't do a whole lot for me. And his AWA match, I didn't really care for that much either.
Yeah, I think it took Steve Williams a long time to really become great. But when he did, he really did. 1993 and 1994 are both like really fantastic years for him in All Japan. But even like, it's interesting. I think before that, my favorite Steve Williams match is probably against Terry Gordy in the UWF. I thought they really matched up against each other really well. But I think at that point, Gordy was the better of the two. But it's kind of like Pillman and Austin, where you're kind of getting the end of Gordy's best days at the same time that you're getting the beginning of the best of Doc's best days.
Peter, what do you think about that? What's your who's your favorite overall as far as career wise?
I have to say Gordy based on what I've seen, but that comes with an asterisk in that I'm not all that familiar with All Japan after about 1992. Right. I got a 93 yearbook in hand. I'm ready to get to it, but that from that point on, where Doc really had his standout matches like with Kobashi and stuff, I haven't seen. So based on what I've seen, I have to go with Gordy. A little more dynamic bumper. I think it was a little more versatile than Doc.
Yeah, I think Doc's 1994 specifically, he's probably, as I watched that year, he was probably one of my top five workers in the world. So it'll be interesting to get your thoughts on that, Peter, when you go through
the footage. I'm also told that the team gets a lot better in 93. That's Gordy's last great year before the coma.
Well, they do have the tag match at the end of January versus Misawa and Kawada is very good. That's probably one of my favorite tag matches of Misawa and Kawada as a tag team. So that's a very good match. Moving on off of them, I want to go to Scott for this tag team. And these are two guys that I think, I guess the sum of them was better than their parts, and that's the New Age Outlaws. And I want to know which team member you thought of them. Kind of two guys that, I guess you can say they sort of floundered in singles runs. I think that may be kind of fair to say, but together in 1998 and early 1999, they really had sort of a magical presence to them. So who was your favorite of this tag team, Scott?
Before I get to that, I want to quickly, two-second note on Gordy and Williams. They had one of the coolest team names that I ever remember, the Miracle Violence Connection. I always thought that was a cool team name. Yeah. And I'm kind of the opposite of Charles and Peter. I'm kind of hankering for a little tag team comp of these guys. So if anybody knows where I can get a good comp of them, particularly Japan, because I'm not too keen on it.
I think you go on Pro Wrestling Only and just keep posting about it and asking for where you can find copies of comp tapes, that's the best way to go about it. Just go on there and just beg
for
them.
True.
Know a guy who knows a guy.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. There's a guy who lives somewhere in Cleveland, but the tape came from as for easily my favorite tag team of the Attitude Era, it's hard to say because obviously one was the worker and one was the steak and one was the sizzle. Obviously Billy Gunn was the steak. He was the better tag worker. We all know what kind of singles guy he was. But obviously Road Dogg was the one that sucked the fans in to the match. Easily my favorite guy though was Road Dogg. I've always been a Road Dogg guy. I liked the way that he was able to. It's not easy to do a lot with very little. Billy Gunn tried to do a lot with very little in his singles run in 99, and as JR and I documented on our Vintage Vaults, didn't really work that well. But in this tag team, Road Dogg was able to do a lot with not much at all, and I think he deserves a lot of credit for that. So just based on the fact that they were able to carry an era where the rest of the tag team division was not stellar, They were a shining star, and I think Road Dogg was the biggest proponent or the biggest reason for that. So if I had to pick a favorite, just based on the fact that he did a lot with not much to make this team great, I would have to say Road Dogg.
Justin, go ahead and jump in with your thoughts.
I guess the way I look at it is, and I mean, we're kind of giving an example with the smoking guns, but I was thinking, like, if you take one of those guys out and put another guy in, how does the team suffer more? And I feel like the team needed... I think Billy was more easily replaceable on that team. I feel like the team needed Road Dogg's mic skills and charisma, connection with the fans, and Billy was just kind of generic in that role. And he was fine. He did, played his role well and got it done and backed up Road Dogg. He was kind of the muscle when it was needed. But I feel like if you take Road Dogg out of that team, it's not nearly as successful.
Now, sort of like with Arn, Billy, of course, has been with many different pairings. So I'll ask both you, Scott and Justin, do you think that his team with Road Dogg was the best one? And if so, what would you put as his number two team? Would it be the Smoking Guns, Billy and Chuck, or who?
Billy Gunn and China? I would definitely say that... I thought the Smoking Guns were his best team, as far as in the ring. I mean, the Outlaws obviously the most successful, the best on the mic and all that, but if you're looking just as the best actual team in the ring, I liked the Guns, especially when they started to get a little more experience by like 95, 96. I thought they were fine in the ring. I mean, you know, are they going to stand up with the greatest teams of all time? No, but I thought, you know, for that time frame and what they were, I thought they were fine. I think that's his best team when you look at in-ring work.
Scott, you agree?
No, actually, I don't. I like the Smoking Guns. But I like Billy and Chuck. I thought Billy and Chuck had good chemistry in the ring. I think Chuck Palumbo was a good compliment to Billy at that time. Billy was the experienced one, and he was able to kind of direct Chuck in those matches. And I think the gimmick kind of ruined their in ring successes. I think if you really watch that stretch for them in 02, Billy and Chuck were a better team than I think people give them credit for because the gimmick was so lousy. I like the Smoking Guns, but sadly, you'll never get a real, in my opinion, I don't think you'll ever get a real indicator of how good those guys were because the rest of the division was garbage. Put the Smoking Guns in 1988. I think you get a good indication.
I disagree, though. I like their matches with Owen and Yoko. I thought those were pretty well worked. I thought they did a good job going toe-to-toe with Owen and then having Yoko come in and dominating them. I thought they worked pretty well there. And even the ones with, you know, heel men on a mission that they had. And
I'll go with you with Owen and Yoko, but I don't know about anybody else. I mean, Owen and Yoko were a good team, but I just think Billy and Chuck with other good teams in 02 really showed, in particular, Billy Gunn's ability to dictate Matt, to be the elder guy and to dictate the match. I'm not dissing the Smoking Guns as a team. I'm just saying that I don't think they were able to shine as much as they could have if they were in an era where what was around them was better. That's all I'm saying. I just think Billy and Chuck don't get as much credit because their gimmick was shit, frankly.
The last tag team that I want to talk about in sort of a round table style and a team that I think is also very closely matched with each other is the Fantastics. Now, this is a team where beyond them with each other, we don't have a ton of footage with them. I know there's a couple of kind of Tommy Rogers and some indies in 1990 matches I've seen, him and ECW, and then also Bobby Fulton with his other brother. But I'll start off with Charles on this one, on which member of the Fantastics does he think was the best one?
Tommy Rogers is usually the guy that gets the credit for being better, and I think that might be true just purely from an athletic standpoint. He was, you know, a fantastic athlete and really good in the ring. I mean, I don't want to just say he was a spot guy, but Bobby Fulton, you could tell in everything he did that Bobby Fulton loved wrestling, and he just loved working in front of a crowd and doing his thing. And he always seemed really excited to be there, like genuinely. And I don't know, that was kind of contagious. And I, I think, and this is more of a sentimental pick for me than it is saying, you know, this is who I think was better, but I prefer Bobby Fulton, and I think I'm in the minority there, but I thought he was a really fun baby face who seemed to always be having the time of his life.
Okay, Scott, what's your opinion on this one?
I'm not going to lie. I've never been a big fan of either guy. This is one of those tag teams that just always annoyed me when I watched them. I never liked when they didn't carry enough weight for me in matches as baby faces. And a couple of times that I've seen them attempt to be heels, I didn't like them either. I don't know.
Is it that they wore bow ties without shirts?
Well, everybody. Well,
that should be a plus.
Yeah, exactly.
They didn't do it as Well Done did, though.
No.
These teams,
or the heartthrobs, and I don't think they wore bow ties. I mean, they were pretty good in World Class. I remember on ESPN they were in a scaffold match with I think it was a Rock and Roll RPMs, some weird team like that. I don't know, they were okay. To me, they kind of blended. I always considered them Rock and Roll Express knockoffs. So I guess if I had to pick one over the other, I don't know. I'll go with Tommy Rogers, I suppose. But be honest with you, I never was a – kind of like Charles and Peter's opinions of Terry Gordy and Dr. Death, the more I watched the Fantastics, the less I kind of cared, to be honest with you. But I do, the one match I will say I liked, and I had it on a tape somewhere, was their scaffold match. I think it was Parade of Champions, I don't know, 4-3, something like that, against the Rock and Roll RPMs. I think it was Rock and Roll RPMs, and I'm pretty sure it was. Sometime in 87, I think. I had it on a tape somewhere. And then, you know, their NWA one was okay. But to me, they just seemed like low rent Rock and Roll Express to me.
Peter, why don't you jump in on this one? And then I also would like for you to talk about their kind of 1990 Japan run. That's really sort of at the tail end of them as a team in some ways.
Well, I don't think they're as good as the Rock and Roll Express anymore. I used to think that, but the Rock and Roll Express might be my number one tag team of all time. One thing Fulton did do better than Rogers was he threw some awesome punches, those uppercut punches to the chin. They were Bobby Eaton-esque, and those were always awesome to watch. But I still think Fulton was a little bit better. I have to stick with the conventional wisdom on that. And I haven't seen a ton of singles from either guy, but I think Rogers was a better singles wrestler as well. I'm going through the 90 yearbook threads right now, trying to remember which matches jump out at me. I know they had a match with Kobashi and Ace in All Japan. That was really good. I think that was in January. I can't remember.
Yeah, it was in September. And then they also had the one with Kikuchi and Joe Malenko.
Kikuchi and Malenko. Yeah. And that features Kikuchi at one point trying to springboard his way from the apron into the ring, missing and plummeting all the way to the floor. And Rogers does not miss a beat for a second. He's setting up to take something from Kikuchi. Kikuchi tumbles to the floor, and Rogers dives out after him as though he's just, you know, opened a Christmas gift or something. It was a great way of covering a blown spot that enhances the match rather than detracts from it. So that just a little thing that shows the greatness of Tommy Rogers.
So we're going to move on now, and we're going to do kind of a rapid fire type session where I'm going to give one person one tag team, and you can give a kind of a sound bite, a couple minutes on the team, any memorable matches, which team member you thought was best, and so forth. And I'm going to start with Justin, and we'll give him the Acolytes.
Oof, Acolytes. At the time, clearly, I think it was Farouk's team. Especially coming off a time where he was horribly out of shape, like in 96 and early 97. He really got himself into really good shape by the end of the year, and then the Acolytes started up. And I just always loved the Spinebusters and the Dominators that he would unleash. As sloppy and dangerous as they were, it was a lot of fun. And I thought Bradshaw really learned, for better or for worse, how to work a better match with Farouk. I thought he really honed his skills, kind of following his lead, and it was clear that he let Farouk take the lead. Now, by the end, when they kind of reunited and came back together like in 03 or whatever, I mean, I think Bradshaw by then was kind of the leader of the team, and Farouk was like the veteran winding down his career. But I think during their peak time, Farouk was the man.
Okay. And Scott, I think we have to give you this one, the Road Warriors.
Easily for me, the standard bearer of all tag teams, and not because of work rate, because obviously there's teams that were better workers easily, but I think they were very good at telling a story better than you think they did. Now, we're not talking about them, you know, back in like the Georgia years where they would walk in and beat the shit out of two bums in 15 seconds. That was highly entertaining for me. One of them was very young Arn Anderson. It's on their DVD. But, and everyone thought they were like the indestructible force and every match was a blowout, you know, squash and everything. I think Hawk should go down as one of the better faces in peril in wrestling history. You can't stop me. I don't think Charles and Peter know where Rutgers is. Maybe they do. My coach bag.
You still live in New Jersey, so yeah.
Well, there you go. All right.
That's future. I'm in Big Ten country, so that's future Big Ten member. Right.
Oh, that is true.
Yeah, enjoy that disaster.
Oh, man.
Yeah, good luck with that.
They beat Arkansas last week.
Easy wins there with those weird Nike helmets. Because they used to they did a really good job of setting themselves up for the big for the big animal hot tag and obviously ending with the Doomsday Device, which is easily one of the greatest tag finishers ever, if not the greatest tag finisher ever. They knew how to get a crowd going. I think they're reading Animal's book. I think their fault was they got a lot too soon. And I think that pissed a lot of promoters off and guys like and other wrestlers. But the proof was in the pudding. I mean, the fans loved them. But who my favorite Road Warrior is? God, that's not easy. Or who I think the better one in the ring was? God, they were both so good at what they did. Like Animal was a great power guy. Hawk was the high flyer, which doesn't say much. You know, because he did the flying shoulder blocks. Little Animal did them too. I would say Animal was probably the more well-rounded of the pair.
Hawk's gonna fly off the Titantron.
Boo! God, I hated
too soon.
God, I hated that. Fuck you, Draws. I think Animal was the maybe because he was less flighty, and I think he had a better sense of the structure of a match. I think I would say Animal was probably the better worker of the two.
Yeah, we're going to have a one-on-one tomorrow as your supervisor. We'll talk about what a lightning round entails, but go ahead.
So you're going with Animal?
Yes.
All right.
Animal's the one, yep.
All right, Peter, I will go with you now, and Doug Furness and Dan Crawford, or Phil LaFon, if you will.
Yeah. I'm almost done with the 92 yearbook, and when I finish any yearbook, I bring up Dave Meltzer's Wrestling Observer Awards ballot and fill out my own ballot 20 plus years after the fact. And it's going to be a close race between them and Los Cowboys, which are Silver King and El Tejano, for best tag team of 1992. They were never going to be pushed as a top tag team in all Japan, but from a work standpoint, they easily had enough to stand with Misawa, Kawada, and Gordy, and Doc, and Hansen, and whoever his partner was at a given time. They were just the other top All Japan teams were basically two big single stars teaming up, and the Can-Ams were a little too closely linked, I think, for them to be a world title contender at that company. But they were a tremendous team. Furness had some incredible strongman spots and some incredible high-flying spots. He had a great drop kick and a Hurricane Rana. But it was really Crawford who was laying the matches out. And it didn't show up in their WWF run, but Crawford was a pretty charismatic heel too. They were sort of miscast as baby faces, and I can understand why, because you already had Owen and the Bulldog, who were like the exact same dynamic as heels. So I can see why they were pushed as baby faces. But in a perfect world, they would have come in and as heels, and Crawford could have acted like the douchebag he came across in All Japan. Andy was a much better singles wrestler. He had great junior heavyweight matches with Masafuchi and one of the best Rob Van Dam matches ever as well. And he really came across as the guy who was laying those matches out, those big, long tag bouts. So I have to give Crawford the edge as the overall worker. But, yeah, just a spectacular tag team at their peak.
Okay. Charles Doom.
I was hoping you would give me Doom. The whole time I'm like, please give me Doom, please give me Doom. I think Butch Reed is an awesome wrestler. I think he's a guy that I think people have just been turned on to within the last few years or so. But what a great wrestler. I mean, he really did. I think he really does have a case, honestly, of being the best black wrestler of all time. As far as when they were teaming, I would probably go with Simmons, but it's not like a runaway. I'm a big fan of Ron Simmons too. I'm not really a big fan of Farouk, but I am a big fan of Ron Simmons. I don't know what made his push not really work when WCW tried to push him, because I mean, he was a guy who could work and who could talk and who had, like, you know, the great athletic background, and I just. For whatever reason, it just never quite clicked. But I think for a career, I would take Butch Reed. But maybe during the tag team, I would go with Simmons.
And what you want to give a couple of their sort of standout matches? I know I'm pretty fond of the Rock and Roll Express Great American Bash 90 match, but they had a good run there in late 90.
Yeah, they had a feud with the Four Horsemen, which I thought was interesting because it was heel versus heel. And I mean, if you look at Doom's run, they worked with top guys. They had a clash match in 91 with Sting and Lex Luger. They had a feud with Ric Flair and Arn Anderson, which is kind of weirdly entertaining, just both from some of the angles that they ran and also the matches in the ring. I think Halloween Havoc 90 is a really fun heel versus heel tag. Doom kind of ends up as like the de facto face in peril in that one. And they're playing up, you know, that Flair is returning to tag team wrestling is kind of a big thing. And it's pretty cool. I wish it would have had a finish, but I thought it was a really well-worked match. And again, it was on a card with, I think, two or three other tag matches, and they all felt different, which I'm always impressed with that when tag matches in the U.S. tend to always have the same formula. But you can put three or four on a card, and they all feel different from each other.
All right, we'll do one more round of this, and I'm going to start with Peter and the Steiner brothers.
I like the Steiner brothers. None of their matches come off as particularly deep, but they're for spot monkeys. They generally execute their spots pretty well, at least in the matches I've watched, and we're not quite to the end of their WCW run, or actually we are at the end of their WCW run, haven't started their WWF stuff yet. I mean, I don't really care for guys like RVD, but when they execute the spots properly, those matches are pretty fun. And I really like the Dome match with Hase and Sasaki. They had a great match in 1990 with the Midnight Express, which I would think would get more love than it does, considering it's two great tag teams who didn't face each other that often. But that was a really great match. And their match with Doc and Gordy at the Clash, which Doc and Gordy sort of forced them into a mat contest, because obviously the Steiners can't just throw them around at will like they do some of their other opponents. So again, they don't have the great classic Southern tag structure of a Rock and Roll Express or a Fantastics, but for bomb fests, short attention span type matches, they're fun to watch.
Chad, have you seen their match against Fujinami and Iizuka from WrestleWar 92?
Yes. Now that is a I still don't know how I think about that match.
Yeah.
I mean, on one hand,
neither do I.
I mean, on one hand, it's of course profoundly unprofessional. the way they just absolutely kill the guys. But on the other hand, it is absolutely entertaining as hell. It actually kind of reminds me of a match that happened in August of this year between Shibata and Ishii, which is one of the highest hyped Puro matches of the common year. And that's sort of the same motif where the guys just absolutely kind of beat the shit out of each other. But that's always an interesting one. I mean, I will say with the Steiners, I'm kind of predisposed to not like the Steiners. They've never been one of my favorites. But seeing them through 1989, like, they had some rough patches. But really, when Scott came in, they were able to put it together fairly quick and kind of get their, their gimmick and their style down. And then they really sort of by force made everybody adapt to that for a while in WCW, which they should be commended. Because, like, 91 and 92, it's pretty much that kind of go-go-go powerhouse style for your main tag matches. So that's interesting how they sort of did that and evolved the division as a whole. Justin, I'll give you the Hardy Boys.
I'm going to look at the later run of the Hardys when they came back together, because I think Matt was really the guy that carried that team in 06. I won't say carried. I think Jeff had improved greatly at that point as well, but I think Matt was clearly kind of the stalwart, and I liked that run better than the original run. I mean, the 99-2000 stuff was fun, and they were killing themselves and throwing the bodies all over the place and had a great connection with the fans and with Lita. But I thought by 06-07, they really had developed into a kind of the veteran team that could anchor the division. And it was funny because I remember the rumors at the time where the WWE wanted to keep them apart. Like, they never officially said they were back as a team, but always be for like one night only or one pay-per-view only. And they were so damn good in the role, and they needed them in the role at that point, that they kept putting them back together and sticking them out there. And then finally they just said, screw it, we'll keep them together. And they had that really good match with the World's Greatest Tag Team, the ladder match. The feud with Kate and Murdoch was good. All the stuff with Eminem. They just had a really, really good run in 06, 07 into 08. And to me, that's always the most memorable Hardy run nowadays, in my mind anyway.
Yeah, I'll just say real quickly, their opener from Royal Rumble 2007 versus Eminem. Really may be one of my favorite. If you start talking about like top 10 WWF tag matches of mm-hmm. all time, that's in contention. That is a very good long match that followed a great story. I don't think Morrison has ever looked as good as he did in that match. He was a beast in that match, and the Hardys were very sympathetic baby faces, kind of did an homage to the Rock and Roll Express in that match. So that's a real underrated classic from the 2000s. Scott, I'll give you the Bushwhackers. I'm just kidding.
What'd you say, the sheep herders? All right, well, they started in... No.
But actually, you kind of touched on them earlier, but Owen and Yoko, that's a kind of interesting team in the sort of doldrum era of WWF tag teams.
They definitely... worked very well together with each other's strengths. Obviously, Yoko, the power guy, not exactly the high flyer, and Owen, obviously the high flyer, and he had the heart trait of dictating the match itself, and Yoko was there to do the squashing. But like JR mentioned earlier, they definitely had the chemistry of a real good, big and little team. They worked well as heels. They definitely, got the most out of the crowd. Obviously, the better worker was Owen, but and he was, I think, the better guy in the team. But Yoko should definitely not be. The problem with Yoko is by the time he came in 95, he weighed like fucking 9 million pounds and could barely move. If it was Owen and Yoko 92 or 93. Then we really got something cooking, because Yoko was much more mobile and much. He was a quick guy in 93 and 94, but by the time he came back in 95, he was a mess. So sadly, they weren't even at their best at that point, or at least Yoko wasn't. But the better team, the better guy was obviously Owen, and they definitely were stalwarts of a very. A dearth of talent in 95.
Just real quickly, do you think Owen and Yoko was the better tag team or Owen and Bulldog? Because, I mean, Owen and Bulldog, I think from a talent standpoint, obviously are. But it does feel like Owen and Yoko, for a time there, got the bigger push.
Well, I think Owen and Yoko were able to stand on their own because they were, yeah, they were in Camp Cornette, but they were kind of like their standalone guys. Owen and Bulldog were kind of enveloped into the Hart Foundation, so I don't think they got as much play on their own as they could have.
Well, and even before the Hart Foundation, they were with the Vader stuff and kind of wrapped up in that Sean feud and everything.
Yeah. I agree, JR. I think Owen and Yoko had a bigger stage of their own. So I think,
but they also had a much weaker year and a much weaker crop of competition. Bulldog and Owen didn't have a great depth tag team, but they were up feuding with, you know, Austin and Sean, and like you said, they were kind of involved in the high end angles. And Owen and Yoko really were able to just kind of dominate the tag division.
That's why I think, as much as Owen and Bulldog were maybe the better team in terms of talent, Owen and Yoko were able to stand alone as a team. Whereas Owen and Bulldog were kind of enveloped in other things involving singles feuds while they were a team. So, if that makes sense.
And now we'll wrap up this segment. I want to talk to Charles about a kind of under the radar team from the Big Two standpoint, but they did have some cups of coffee in there, and that's the Heavenly Bodies.
Yeah, the Heavenly Bodies were obviously the spiritual, like, predecessor to the Midnight Express. They had a couple of really good matches in Smoky Mountain Wrestling. My favorite being the Loser Leaves Town match with the Rock and Roll Express from Bluegrass Brawl in 94. They had some really fun, like, crazy matches with the Gangstas in Smoky Mountain where they brawled all over the parking lot. And legend has it that because they brawled out into the street, that someone called the police because they thought that there was a real fight happening. I thought they were really good. Tom Pritchard and Stan Lane, I don't know that they were a really strong team because Stan Lane at that point, I think, had checked out of wrestling. Those matches are funny to watch because Stan Lane is wearing a toupee and they made an angle where he had headgear because he had a busted eardrum just so his toupee would stay on during his matches. But his toupee is so obviously fake that I can't do anything but stare at it when they're on screen. That's all I can focus on. But then I think when he moved on to team with Jimmy Del Rey, that's when they became really good. Jimmy Del Rey is a pretty underrated wrestler too. And I think he replaced Stan Lane like sometime in either mid or late 1993. And then from there, I think that's when the team kind of peaked, like especially in 1994 when they really blew off the feud with the Rock and Roll Express. I think between the two of them, I would probably even say Jimmy Del Rey may have been the guy who, I wouldn't say he carried the team, but I do think he was the more outstanding wrestler of the two, believe it or not. Tom Pritchard definitely had the better career, but I would actually go with Jimmy Del Rey just within the context of the team.
Yeah, just a really quick sidebar there. As some of you know, I'm on a school board for a local school here in the county I live in, and another school board member looks just like Jimmy Del Rey. He's the doppelganger. So we had a fall festival last year, and he lived up to the name Gigolo Jimmy Del Rey, because I swear, as God is my witness, you know, kind of the little shimmy dance Jimmy Del Rey used to do? They were playing a Katy Perry song, and sure enough, this guy's name's David, but he was shimmying out there just like Jimmy Del Rey did. And it was one of the wildest things I've ever seen, because all I could think about was Jim Cornette announcing him. He looked just like Jimmy Del Rey.
Not many people could look like him either.
No, a very distinctive look. I mean, same haircut, same kind of the skin complexion. It's very weird. There it is. I do love their theme song.
Yeah, it was good.
Yeah, so we've wrapped up and we went through a lot of tag teams here. Of course, there's tons more. This could be a multi-part series, but I think we've hit the highlights of at least the past probably 20 years and some of the big-name tag teams where the members are pretty closely matched with each other. So in closing, and we're going to go around so everybody can speak, I want us to if you have an underrated or overrated tag team, to call that out. And then who you think the best tag team worker individually was, and then your best tag team overall is. And we'll start with Peter.
Underrated and overrated, I have to think about that. I think overrated I already touched on, and that would be Doc and Gordy.
Okay.
While I'm thinking about underrated, I'll just say best working tag team I've ever seen would probably be the Rock and Roll Express. And the big reason for that would be the best tag worker I've ever seen, and that would be Ricky Morton. I don't know if I really have to elaborate on that too much. Underrated tag teams. I'm drawing a blank on it. If I think of one, I'll barge in with one.
And just real quickly, what do you think overall is the best Rock and Roll Express match if you had to pick one match?
Probably their Wrestle War 90 match with the Midnight Express, okay, which is sort of the last gasp of the rivalry.
Yeah, great choice. Scott, we'll throw to you with those questions.
Overrated. I would say an overrated tag team. Probably have to be any combination of the Von Erichs. Never really liked any of them in matches. They're good workers, but I never really liked any of their combinations. Whether it be Kevin Carey, Kevin Mike, Kevin David, I don't know. They were good solo guys, particularly David, but I don't know. I never liked them in tag teams. I was never a big Von Erichs fan to begin with. I grew up liking the Freebirds. So, underrated? Underrated team? They're pretty difficult. Chronic? No, I'm just kidding. I think JR would think Chronic is underrated. So, it's a tough one because there's so many teams that you could see that were just short, but due to lack of time or lack of
American Mets.
Oh God. Oh, yeah. Matt Rotella was on maybe. Oh God. Underrated. I don't want to get this. I don't want Hatch to go back to me too. But
I have my pick, and then I'm going to take off, and that's Chavo and Hector Guerrero. Watching the Mid South set, going back to that, I thought they were actually better than the Midnight Express. They were great as heels working with the Rock and Roll Express, and just as good as baby faces working against the heel Fabulous Ones. And they had one of my all time favorite non screw job finishes against the Rock and Roll Express, where the Guerreros have Robert Gibson in a double surfboard Romero special, that elevated surfboard move, and which is cool enough as it is. And then Ricky Morton comes in and crawls atop both of them, and their shoulders are down, and the referee counts three. And that's still one of my all-time favorite finishes to a tag match, and something that should be ripped off a lot more. So, yeah, that's my pick for most underrated.
Awesome. I'll give you an overrated tag team to go with the Von Erichs, the Bushwhackers. underrated tag team. I think I'm going to steal one of JR's teams, because we talked a lot about them the last couple weeks. I'd say the Twin Towers. I don't think they ever got enough credit for being an awesome big man tag team, because they were, you know, kind of the foils for the Mega Powers. But in another era, I think the Twin Towers would have been one of the most awesome big guy tag teams of all time. But I think they were just stuck in the Mega Powers run, that they didn't really get the full credit they deserved.
Charles, what about you?
For underrated tag teams, I'd probably say the Quebecers, actually. The Quebecers were really good. I mean, they didn't last very long, but they had a pretty hot series of matches. I love the match where they screwed the Steiners out of the tag team titles with the rules. I thought that was amazing, actually. And I really like the match where they dropped the titles also to 1-2-3 Kid and Marty Jannetty. And then even the house show match at Madison Square Garden where they won them back. And then they did the Bret Owen match at the Royal Rumble, and all of those I thought were really good. So that would probably be my pick for underrated. For overrated, I want to say Doc and Gordy, but just so I'm picking a different team, I'll pick the Steiner brothers. I don't hate the Steiner brothers, but I don't think that they're in like the upper echelon of all-time tag teams at all. I
agree with that, actually. I agree with you on that.
Yeah. I think the best tag team wrestler that I can think of is probably it's probably Arn Anderson.
Okay.
Yeah, just I think the reason I'm thinking of Arn Anderson is also because he had a tag team with Ric Flair, and Flair obviously we know is like probably, you know, the best singles wrestler who ever lived, but
besides Bret Hart.
Yeah, yeah, of course. But I still really like I like Arn teaming with Flair, because I think Flair sometimes in tag matches, because he's so used to carrying the load, he doesn't tag out very often. And I think Arn kind of says, I don't know, I think Arn maybe keeps him in check a little bit. So Arn is good, I think, at teaming with people who maybe aren't great tag team wrestlers and still having good matches. And actually, I think Flair's a really good tag wrestler. It's just that's the one thing I've always noticed is he stays in the ring too long. But that would be probably my best tag team worker. And then my best tag team would probably be the Rock and Roll Express.
Okay. And Scott, what was your best overall tag worker and best tag team?
Oh, well, best tag team, obviously, the Road Warriors. Right. Best tag worker? I'd have to say a tie between Arn and Bret.
Okay.
I think Bret Hart doesn't get nearly enough credit as you look at his career now for being a good tag worker. Anvil was never chopped liver, but Anvil, obviously, there's a reason they created the Hart Foundation. It wasn't because Bret was a lousy singles wrestler, that's for sure. I think Bret has worked with so many guys, whether it was a full tag team or just, you know, here and there. The guy was an incredible worker when working with somebody else. I think him and Owen could have had for storyline purposes, they had to get broken up. But if him and Owen had a legitimate long run, they'd have been tremendous. But I think him and I think Arn are easily the two best tag workers of all time, with an honorable mention to Billy Gunn.
What's your favorite Hart Foundation match? Is it the Brainbusters from SummerSlam 89?
Yeah, it's tough not to say that. That match is incredible. They meshed with – and what I liked about it is you're dealing with two NWA guys, and we all know NWA work and WWF work are apples and oranges. It's very simple. And a credit to Arn and Tully for kind of meshing into the WWF style of tag team wrestling. JR, you've said it all the time about – there's no heat segments. One, you know, no face. The face in peril didn't work a lot in that aspect. It was very back and forth. Same thing in WCW in the 90s. And I think it was. I don't think any match was better for them than that one with the Brainbuster. And incidentally, my best Road Warriors match.
Yeah.
Even though they lost, was Arn and Tully at Starrcade '87. I always loved that match.
Okay. One match I wanted Charles to kind of quickly touch on is a match that I'd never heard of. But it made the 1995 yearbook, and it's Bret Hart and Davey Boy Smith versus Owen Hart and Bob Backlund on Action Zone.
Oh, yeah.
That's kind of an under. I'd never heard of that match, but I know Charles loved it when he watched it.
Yeah, absolutely love that match. The only match that I would put above that for the year in the WWF would be the Shawn Michaels Razor Ramon ladder match at SummerSlam. I thought it was just so good. Bret was face in peril in that match and gave a really great performance. Owen did some awesome stuff. Owen and Backlund both actually did some awesome stuff to Bret's knee. And they built to the hot tag. And Jim Ross was kind of in Mid-South mode for that one and how he called it. And it really added a lot to the atmosphere. It's something I would recommend that anyone check out.
And quickly, too, one thing that we sort of touched on with the Quebecers talk, and Justin, I know you can jump in here, is kind of how in early 1994, there was a short time there where the WWF has never had a ton of focus on the tag division if you look at their history as a whole. But in early 1994, there was a big focus there. It kind of peaked with the Brett Owen versus Quebecers tag at the Rumble, which was, you know, it was a third from the top match, but a big feud match that had been built to. But you also had kind of the Bob Holly 1-2-3 Kid team that was together. And then
that was actually Jannetty and Kid.
It was Jannetty. Yeah, that's right. It was Jannetty there. And that they had a good series with the Quebecers. There's an MSG match from early in that year that's very good. So if you want to touch on that kind of time period, a forgotten period, I think.
Well, that was, Scott kind of took my thunder a little bit because when I was going to say my best, I think the best tag team in my eyes is the Rockers. That's just the team I kind of grew up with that always had the good matches, always worked well. And I thought they, again, were hitting their peak in 91 when they broke up. And I think they could have been the team, premier team, if they stuck together just a little bit longer. But one I was going to say that I thought had all the potential in the world and we just never got the run, and Scott mentioned it, was Bret and Owen Hart. And I think if you look at them in 94, if they had an extended run before their feud, I don't know what they could have put on. They have that awesome match with the Steiners that's on the Coliseum home video.
Yeah.
And that match is phenomenal. And then the Quebecers match is really damn good. Not only was it a well-built feud, the match was really well worked too. And the Quebecers, to me, are an underrated team, and they're an overlooked team. And, you know, everyone kind of giggles when you mention them because they think of the theme song and the goofy gimmick. But they could fucking go. And, you know, you add Johnny Polo to the mix, and they were just a great threesome, a great heel threesome during a time. And they're another team, too, that got an aborted run. They lost to the Head Shrinkers. It was a good match. And then they were gone. And I'm like, where'd they go? Why'd they leave? They were so good. They came back for that one rematch on the Countdown to the Crowning or whatever, and then they were gone forever. Well, not gone forever, but gone forever is a great team. By the time they came back, they were kind of a shell. But
the Amazing French Canadians were an awesome team on WCW Saturday Night.
They were. But as far as a high profile run, they were pretty much done. As far as the best tag worker, I think Arn's the easy choice there. I'm going to throw Owen in as well, though, because I feel like he's a guy, whether it was with Stampede or with Brett or with Yoko, with Bulldog, with Jeff Jarrett, he's kind of a guy that had a lot of very good tag team runs as well and always high profile and worked well. He meshed in with any team he was part of. Underrated, besides, of course, Power and Glory. I'm going to say Haku and Barbarian, or it's Haku / Ming. I don't think they're underrated on all corners of the internet or anything like that, but I think history, just time, kind of forgets them. They were a team that always had pretty good matches on Nitro and WCW and kind of got overshadowed when the Outsiders came in. But also their Dirty F stuff I thought was pretty good too, so that'd be an underrated team for me. And what's left? Just overrated? I did best. It's, yeah, overrated, and Scott's going to think I'm just picking on him, but I think the Road Warriors. I honestly do. Maybe it's because I wasn't around when they were at their peak, but to me, it was always a bunch of squash matches. Then they had a couple good years in there, and then the Dirty F stuff to me always just seemed fine, but not like greatest tag team ever. Like when I watched that stuff, like the Nasty Boys match, it's good. Match with Money Inc., it's good. Best tag team ever? No, I don't think so. Flame away.
I will just say, personally, somebody that watched the 1990 footage, in the NWA, they feel pretty much like toast before then. Like in 1990,
right,
they were done.
Yeah.
And then when they do go to the WWF, like they had that first appearance, I think, did they actually debut on the Brother Love show? Somebody can help me with that. I know they debuted before SummerSlam, but SummerSlam was kind of their big kind of peak moment when they came out, but they sort of got lost in. I mean, I know they were involved with the Warrior versus all three members of Demolition, that whole mess, but that really felt like a pretty poor feud in the fall, even though it was kind of the
right.
What they were trying to push is the second highest profile feud or whatever. You really kind of felt like, okay, let's get on to Warrior versus Savage, which they were teasing.
And then even their first WrestleMania match is just a squash.
Right.
I don't know. I think they had they're great for that couple year stretch. Other than that, I thought it was just a bunch of squashes and bullying, and I never really bought their act completely.
Right. And Rocco.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't think Vince. No, JR, you're not wrong. At least in part.
No, I know I'm not.
You're partially wrong. Their WWF run was not indicative of why they were great. Squashes, yes, there were a lot of them, particularly in the early years. But you actually mentioned, you just reminded me of another overrated tag team, and that's the Nasty Boys. I just thought they sucked. They're lousy workers.
I don't think anyone ever rated them highly, though. I mean, fun brawlers, I guess. But
yeah,
I don't think anyone ever looks at them wistfully and say, oh, I wish the Nasty Boys were still around.
Wistfully, yes. I don't think anyone could look at Knobs and think wistfully.
I want to hear Charles' take on the Road Warriors. I'm curious. I know your take on them. I know you get
That's what I'm not going to say. Go ahead, Charles.
But Charles, go ahead.
I like the Road Warriors a lot, too. I don't know that I'm as huge of a fan, but I thought they were a really good team. And I always thought, in some ways, how good they were in the ring was underrated. And I put them kind of in the same category as Goldberg, and I mean that as a compliment. And what I mean by that is, yes, they were pushed, and yes, they won a lot. But if they hadn't been able to deliver the type of match in the ring that fit the gimmick, then the gimmick would have bombed in both cases. And I think, you know, the Road Warriors were really good at giving the type of match. I mean, and not just going in and winning, but going in and looking like ass kickers that was needed from them. So I give them, you know, a lot of credit for that.
Okay. I'm going to give my picks. Overrated team, I'm actually going to go with the Hart Foundation. That may be a little controversial, but I think they were a good tag team. But when I've watched footage and really think about the best WWF tag teams, I would not put them at the level of for sure the Rockers, and then even their best matches to me kind of lose a little something. So I think they were slightly overrated in the fact that I think a lot of people would put them as like a top five tag team, and they're just not there for me as far as WWF or WCW is concerned. Underrated is tougher, really tough without kind of going very obscure. I may say the Fantastics, just from the standpoint that for me, the Fantastics' best stuff versus the Midnight Express, I think matches up just as well as the Rock and Roll Express stuff. I think it's some of the best tag team matches in North America. I really like their Japan run in 1990. I thought that match versus Ace and Kobashi was really cool. Also, they had a match versus Kawada early on in the year in a tag that I thought was a pretty cool match too. So I really like the Fantastics and what they were able to do, and would put them up there with overall workers. And then for my best worker and tag team, we can lump them, and it's a team we really didn't talk about much, and I do want to talk about this team and one other team as we wrap up. And my overall best tag worker would be Bobby Eaton, and mainly, of course, for his work with the Midnight Express. And actually, I just thought of another underrated tag team, the Fabulous Ones. The Fabulous Ones, real quickly, are amazing in everything they've done. They have the look, they have the gimmick, and they've had really fun matches in both Memphis and AWA that I've watched. But Bobby Eaton and the Midnight Express, and we can kind of go round table on which Midnight Express pairing we think was best, either him with Lane or him versus with Condrey. I personally like the Lane pairing, I think, actually. But that team overall, to me, personifies like work rate tag teams, but also being able to have a gimmick and draw, have a great mouthpiece manager and Cornette. To me, they're the total package. So I'll ask Charles what his favorite Midnight Express pairing is.
I like them both equally, actually, but I think it's interesting because I think they both were great at what they were supposed to do. So Bobby Eaton and Dennis Condrey were a main event tag team. You know, they in Mid-South, the Rock and Roll Express feud was on top. Their feud with Bill Watts and Junkyard Dog was on top. When they feuded with Magnum and Dusty, that was on top. When they feuded with the Road Warriors, that was on top. So they wrestled more of like a heat-seeking style. Maybe it wasn't quite as athletic, but it really, I mean, it was like a typical like main event tag team, and I thought they were great at it. Whereas the Bobby Eaton Stan Lane version of the Midnight Express, what really was more of a mid-card tag team that was giving you like the high work, great all action match that more often than not would steal the show. So, I mean, I think both tag teams were equally great. I think the difference between the two teams is kind of interesting, and just because I do think there was a difference in the role of each team. I mean, I'd probably actually lean slightly toward the Stan Lane version also, but I really do like the Dennis Condrey version too.
Yeah, there's a golf analogy that I'm actually going to make with that, and that's there's a golf saying that says you can drive for show and putt for dough. And to me, that kind of is in comparison to both teams, because the team with Lane was very a showy team. But then when you got to the meat and potatoes and drawing, the team with Condrey drew more money, was a more kind of grittier, hated team, I think, overall. So there is a very big contrast there. Scott, what's your thoughts on these guys?
I don't know if Scott's with
us. Did we lose Scott? Okay, Justin, do you want to...
Yeah, I'll go.
Oh, right. Sorry.
Oh, oh,
I'm here.
Okay.
Right. Okay. But my didn't click. Sorry.
Wake up.
I was talking about Yokozuna. No, I'm like, no, I've always been a big Condrey guy. Probably because the whole gimmick of him being Loverboy Dennis, and he pretty much looked like Moolah with a beard. I think made the gimmick even better. But I concur with the analogy that him and Lane, Bobby Eaton and Lane, were that mid card solid team. Whereas Eaton and Condrey seemed to always be at the top of the card, even if they weren't exactly the best workers combined like Lane was. I've never been a big Stan Lane guy. I just think Condrey fit the mold of that team with Cornette better than him than he did with Stan Lane. But I know Stan Lane was there when they were baby faces feuding with Paulie's Midnight Express in, what was it, like 89? 88, 89.
Yeah, yeah.
So I would have to say I just thought Condrey and Eaton were just a better team for that run of just good heel work and just being so arrogant when they both were nearly clearly not good looking guys, and they just played it off so well. So I think the total package, I have to say I like Eaton and Condrey.
Okay. Now one team that we also didn't mention, and I want to mention them. We don't have to kind of belittle the point, but I don't want people yelling at us that we didn't mention them. And the reason is I think one member is clearly better than the other. But I think we would be remiss if we didn't give our thoughts and mention a little bit about Demolition. I thought they might come up in the best tag team. So, Justin, just give us a few thoughts on Demolition. You can talk about for the 18th million time your favorite moment with them, which I know what you'll say. But I think we do need to kind of speak on them a little bit.
Of course, the best moment was when they wrestled Katao and Tenryu at WrestleMania 7. No, I obviously they were it as a kid. I mean, I talked about the Rockers, talked about the Hartford Nation, but Demolition were just the badass. If you were a WWF only fan, like I was up until about 91, they were the team you knew. They were the team that ran through everyone, presented as the kings of the tag division. They looked the part, they acted the part, they had confidence, they had the paint, they had the spikes, and beat the shit out of everyone in their way. Of course, WrestleMania 6, to me, is their capping moment. That awesome moment there when they finish off the Colossal Connection and Bobby gets smacked down by Andre and the crowd's just going insane and Jesse on commentary is great and they become three-time champions for the first time. And it was just all really, really well done. And I always remember them for that. Now, if you look back work-wise, sure, they fall to the middle of the pack and I think that's probably why they didn't come up. But when you're talking just like nostalgia-wise, to me, they're what you associate with WWF tag wrestling at that time period.
Scott, I know you're a pretty big fan also.
Oh, Demolition was an incredible team. But who needed a work rate? Who cared? I mean, they were just big bruising mofos who just brawled and battled, and the fans loved them. You know, sometimes work rate is not as necessary, particularly in Vince's vision of the late 80s. But they made money. They were moneymakers. And for those 2 years, from WrestleMania 4 to WrestleMania 6, they were untouchable. But I enjoy their – if you get a chance to watch them, I love their 87, even before Barry came along and it was Randy Cully. I kind of dug those matches too. We watched those in a lot of prime times. Those guys were pretty cool. Those guys were a pretty cool combination as well. So, yeah, I mean, they were moneymakers. They were Vince's first legitimate pay-per-view tag team moneymakers and should not definitely be forgotten in the pantheon of great tag teams.
And Charles, I'm actually, again, interested to hear your opinion on this one, because I know in the pro wrestling only world, this is a pretty heated debate, too, where your partner, Will, hates Demolition, but they also have some defenders like Matt, our buddy Matt over there. So what's your opinion on them?
I don't think I've seen enough where I've really paid attention to fairly judge, so I'll just say that their accent smash, their Demolition.
very constitutional of you, Charles. I will say that I do think their match, I want to say, is it October or December 1980? It's late 1988. It's versus the Rockers. It's at Madison Square Garden. That's a very good match. And again, that goes to the Rockers, like Justin brought them up. I mean, they really are that they have the they have that match with Demolition. They have the Hart Foundation match, the Phantom title change. Yeah, the Powers of Pain match. They have the Orient Express match, the Brainbusters match, the Series versus Rose and Summers.
Haku and Barbarian.
Then they also have the Rougeau's match from London, which I know that's either kind of a love-hate type match, but there's some big proponents of to that match too, and that's a great match on its own right, in my opinion. So that's very...
Plus the six-man at SummerSlam 89 is really good. They play a big role
in that. Yeah, I mean, they have a very good variety where really anybody they were thrown in, even some of those Conquistador matches are pretty good when they first debuted. So a cool team, and we really discussed a lot of great tag teams, and I had a blast doing it.
Yeah, you guys have really made this podcast the place to be.
You love it. All right, Chad. Great job hosting, by the way. That was ran things very smoothly, and it was a great discussion. And Charles, would love to have you and Peter both back on. We're going to try and make these summits maybe once every few months. I already have a good idea for the next one that kind of falls in line with our reviews that we're doing. So we'll go ahead and wrap things up. I think over the last 2 weeks, we've given you all the tag wrestling you could handle. So hopefully you guys go out check out some of the stuff we recommended. So Scott, we'll be back next week. Monday night with No Mercy 2000, and then Wednesday night with some headlines, and we'll talk about, we'll preview the pay-per-view and all the other stuff going on. And no NFL picks this week. You can just visit PlaceToBeNation.com for all your NFL coverage, and we'll catch up with you next week in the world of football. So, for Peter and Charles and Chad and Scott, I'm Justin. Everyone, have a great weekend. We'll talk to you Monday night.
Peace.
Jones.